Play and stay on Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. Stand up paddleboarding, hiking, great restaurants and breweries. I'll tell you more about your next vacation destination later in the show. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, the show where celebrities share stories about the foods they love most, and we dig into the history, culture, and science of those meals with experts from around the world. Today on the program, actor and comedian Tom Papa. Tom has 4 comedy specials streaming on Netflix. He's written 2 books. He's on a big comedy tour right now through the end of July, and he's a big sourdough bread baker. Tom hosted a show on the Food Network called Baked, and he has a podcast called Breaking Bread with Tom Papa. And yes, Tom has been baking sourdough since before the pandemic. How did you really feel when everybody became a sourdough baker? Did you feel this possessive, like, this is my hobby?
Yes, I did. When I saw Jake Gyllenhaal on Colbert talking about his bread baking and how he's really into it, I'm like, I love him, but as soon as he can get out of his house, he's not baking bread anymore.
No, he's going to go back to like water skiing on 2 dolphins.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I'll be still making bread.
Tom may have started baking sourdough before the pandemic, but I chat with a Seattle bread baker who uses a starter from the Klondike Gold Rush. Who's the hipster now? And buttered noodles with Parmesan. The holy grail of American picky kid food. But in Italy, that dish has an entirely different context. All of that coming up later in the show. But first, my conversation with Tom Papa. You've been a stand-up comedian since 1993. And in the past several years, you have been known for bread breaking. Bread, oh my gosh, bread baking is the name of your show.
Breaking bed.
Breaking Bad. Yeah. How did this come to be? How did your love of bread baking start?
I was working on a TV show as a writer, and one of the other writers came in and he said, do you know how sourdough bread is made? He said, I just learned this. There's a sourdough starter and it's this living yeast. And he just told the whole story. And I relayed it to my family when I was home for dinner. And it just sounded like science fiction, and it sounded very cool. And I had cooked forever, but I didn't know anything about sourdough starter.
I love that this guy asked you. It made me think of like being in elementary school or middle school and 2 boys on the schoolyard. Like, do you know where sourdough comes from? It's like the birds and the bees of bread.
Did your parents tell you where bread comes from? And then my daughter for Christmas got one started. She was like, I don't know, 12. And she took some flour and water, put in a little bowl, let the magical yeast that was in our kitchen dive in and get it going. And she gave it to me for Christmas.
That's so sweet that she made a homemade starter at 12. And for people who don't know, this is pre-pandemic, before the world was into starters.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome.
I feel like everyone that got into it after, I feel like I was into that band when they were cool. Like, oh, you people. So she got it going and I made it. And after a couple of loaves, I was hooked. I just loved the process of it. I liked the rhythm of it. Baking to me was always something out of my reach because I'm not that scientific and that specific. I'm a little sloppy. And I just got obsessed with it and have not stopped. When I'm home, it's at least 2 loaves a week. I just love it. And then, you know, once you made it, it was like, oh, the bread that I've been eating has been horrible.
Yeah.
For my whole life, it's been terrible. I would buy these beautiful labels, you know, with like a country wooden sign on it. And I'm like,
country
this will be
pride.
Good for my family. Yeah. Country pride. Yes,
home
exactly.
Pride.
You know, 1,000 ingredients and all of this sugar and all this other stuff. And then I realized this tastes amazing. It's better for us. I found out I used to go on like Conan and places and be like, why could we eat this for thousands of years without issue? And we show up and you're told bread is the enemy.
I know, it's really bad timing for us.
Horrible timing. But it's because we weren't talking about real bread. It was not flour, water, salt, and yeast. That combination you can eat. I have friends that have not severe gluten issues, but they were kind of gluten intolerant and they could eat my bread and be okay with it.
Yeah.
Because it was a pure product. if we go back to what bread was for all this time, you can eat it and enjoy it.
Yeah, well, this idea that humans have subsisted off of bread for thousands of years and then saying like, oh, I'm so sorry, carbs are bad, I'm not eating carbs. It's like, what?
I know.
It's crazy.
I know.
Do you have the whole vernacular? Do you find yourself saying things like crumb structure a lot or hydration? Are you having these like nerd out beer talk about bread with your buddies?
Yeah. Not to name drop, but I was hosting an award show on Saturday and Jon Favreau was backstage and we've had conversations about bread and we're both about to like go out in front of 1,000 people and present and tell jokes and do stuff. And we're in the back looking at bread pictures and talking about hydration. And
you have like the spread. You're like, look at this one, man. It's July.
Yeah.
Miss July.
Right. Exactly. She was hot.
She's so hot right out of the oven.
Yeah. No, I do love talking about it. I'm constantly collecting books on it. I can just read it all the time. There's something very sticky about this hobby that once you get into it, you can't stop learning it. I compare it to stand-up comedy in a big way because it's always as good as you can get. It's always humbling. You're always learning and you can always fail. You never really have it on lock.
Does your sourdough starter have a name?
Well, I have two of them and my daughter's name is Angelina and I call her Lena. And there's an L on the lid of that mason jar. And the other one is just this unwieldy beast that doesn't deserve a name.
Oh, God.
It's a monstrosity.
Him of who we do not speak.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And now it's your turn.
What does this starter do?
It's for some reason, my daughter's is lighter and super active, and it's like an old reliable. This other one was from my friend who I heard that original story from that he had gotten from someone. It was like an offshoot of the La Brea Bakery lineage. Who knows? But that one, it's like big and earthy and slower. It takes more feedings to get it like ready. Once it does, it's great. It gives it bread a much earthier, deeper, complex flavor.
Yeah.
But it's in a fatter jar. It's got a nasty stuff around it. It's a beast.
That's so funny. It's making me think of like water for chocolate, you know, with the cooks. Their personality would come through the food that you ate. So if they were angry, you get angry. So a very bad, maybe it's like Vladimir Putin's starter or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Or that it was handed off to me in a writer's room filled with angst. And
Yeah, that could be it too.
Yeah.
If you take good care of your sourdough starter, which basically means feeding it flour and water and keeping it at the right temperature, it can live for generations. You can make one from scratch like Tom's daughter did for him, or you can buy one online. But when I wanted to start experimenting with baking sourdough bread, I asked a friend to give me a chunk of her starter because I really like the story that comes along with it. My sourdough starter is a golden girl. Her name is Dorothy. Dorothy. Get it? And she came from my friend Colleen's starter, whose name is Willa, and she got her starter from a place called Ballerina Farm. A sourdough starter recently went viral on TikTok because it is believed to be from 1847 and carried through the Oregon Trail. You can order a chunk of this starter online from the Sourdough Preservation Society. It's actually free. They have been doing this for decades. You just have to send a self-addressed stamped envelope to a woman in Colorado who is now fielding thousands of orders after word got out on social media. Here in Seattle, there is a bakery with a super cool sourdough story. I actually reported on this back in 2018 when I was working for Cairo Radio, but I think this story is so neato that I want to play it for you now. Please enjoy my news reporter voice. On July 17th, 1897, the headline of a Seattle newspaper read, "Gold, gold, gold, gold." The Klondike Gold Rush put dollar signs in the eyes of Seattleites and San Franciscans, and about 70,000 prospectors made their way north to try and hit it rich. And at least half of those people bought their supplies for the long, cold journey in Seattle, therefore christening the city as, quote, "gateway to the gold fields," and literally putting Seattle on the map. Most of those prospectors relied on sourdough bread to keep them fed during that journey. Some carried their precious sourdough starter in a pouch around their neck, neck, or even slept with it in their sleeping bag at night. According to an article in Edible Seattle, crusty old prospectors who returned from the Yukon were even called sourdoughs. At Seattle's Essential Baking Company headquarters, 16 million loaves of bread are baked every year. And most of them contain a chunk of the same century-old sourdough starter that fed prospectors during the gold rush. 40-year veteran baker George DePisquale founded Essential Baking in 1994. And when he was preparing to open and lining up vendors,
the guy who was selling me cleaning chemicals said, you know, I have a starter that's been in my family for a long time. Maybe you want a sample, you know, a little bit of it. And I said, sure. So he brought it back along with like a family tree that he had drawn up with all the people he's given starter to, you know. And apparently the starter's been in the family since the gold rush, since the late 1800s or whatever. Yeah, so it's a super romantic story. You know, the guy was like, you know, the baker for the caravan up from Seattle to Alaska and kept the starter in the bottom of his sleeping bag. And, you know, it was like his great grandpa or something like that. Completely unverifiable story, but very romantic.
Let's explain what a sourdough starter is.
It's a natural yeast culture, is a simplistic way of describing it. So instead of having like the little packets of dried out yeast that you're used to, that you add to the dough to make it rise, we have a continuing culture of microbes. Some of that is yeast, some of it is lactobacilli, some of it is a whole group of other microbes. It's this whole colony of microbes that we are cultivating and taking care of and creating an environment for them to live happy little lives before we throw them in the oven and kill them all.
In addition to the starter that is fed and replenished daily, George also keeps some of the mother in the bakery's fridge, just in case of emergency. And he keeps a chunk at home for extra insurance. He says sourdough bread is just as much a part of Northwest history as it is San Francisco's, the city most famous for the tangy, crusty bread. But using a starter as opposed to dry yeast is the original way that the first breads were made thousands of years ago. The Encyclopedia of Food Microbiology says, quote, one of the oldest sourdough breads dates from 3700 BCE and was excavated in Switzerland.
You know, like the first archaeological discovery of bread that was uncovered was in Ethiopia, something similar to what I imagine injera is now. And so that whole story is how we discovered bread. For many, many years, people were grinding grains and mixing them with water and baking them on hot surfaces, you know, and flatbreads. You know, the idea is that at some point, some baker somewhere left the batter out a little too long and it started bubbling. And went, well, I don't know, I'll just bake it anyway, you know, and see what happens. Instead of flat pancakes, you got nice fluffy pancakes, you know. So he said, okay, well, that's pretty cool. So, you know, maybe as he noticed it starting to die, maybe put more flour in there and see what happens. So, all really intuitive, all really symbiotic kind of, you know. And that was literally 10,000 years ago.
Using sourdough starter as opposed to dry yeast is what gives sourdough bread its delicious tang and its satisfying chew.
The sourdough, the flavors are much more complex, and that's really the real reason I'm so married to this process, you know.
Actually, there is one other reason.
The history is super important to me, actually, you know. I love being part of that stream of bakers from, you know, 8,000, 10,000 years ago to now and beyond. That part of it's fun. I have no way of knowing what happened to that starter in the 150 years or so that it was alive. So I'm sure it was used and abused and cared for and discarded. And so it was fun to kind of get it back. And now it's, at least my part of it, is very robust and healthy.
As I watch the dough get mixed and formed in the bakery, I realize that I might be looking at the oldest living artifact in Seattle history. After the break, how a Roman chef took a meal that Italians only eat when they're sick and turned it into one of the most popular pasta dishes at the Olive Garden. If you're a fan of naturally gorgeous, off-the-beaten-path vacation spots with small-town charm, You're going to want to plan a visit to Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, where you can grab a scoop of homemade ice cream and stroll around the adorable European seaside village of Paulsbo, or walk on the ferry in Seattle and get off in downtown Bainbridge Island. And May is the perfect month to visit Bremerton or Silverdale, where you can get out of the city and into the forest in just 15 minutes for a beautiful hike. Enjoy a farm-to-table meal at Bremerton's Restaurant Lola, a Black-owned business. I really need to make the trip out there for their Creole brunch. And in the morning, stop by Saboteur Bakery for croissants that are so flaky and buttery, you'll think you're in Paris. There's also a gorgeous golf course in the middle of the forest, and there are several naval museums in Bremerton. Go to visitkitsap.com/yourlastmeal to learn more. That's K-I-T-S-A-P. Or you can find a link in the show notes. Play and stay on the Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. In your book, you had an essay, or maybe it was a chapter, called Welcome to Plain Pasta. Can I take your order? Can you talk about what it was like feeding your kids when they were growing up?
Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning, actually. Not only were they finicky, their children, like my daughter would see like a flake of pepper and something and be like, what did you do? Something here is
trying
not
to kill
right.
Me.
I'm not eating this. It was tricky cooking for them. And then they were all vegetarians. My wife's a vegetarian.
Oh.
And then my kids followed suit.
But not you.
But not me.
Okay.
I've dabbled and I've kind of gone in and out of it, but I've been out of it more than in it. So I was always making multiple things each night. Yeah, it was tricky.
I have to say, though, like the plain pasta thing, if you have kids, seems like a nightmare. But as an adult and someone who's never been picky, that's still my comfort food. Just pasta with butter and Parmesan and salt. It is so good.
They're not wrong. You're not wrong. We were in this Italian restaurant in the village when she was really little. And my younger, that was it, the same, just buttered pasta. And we were saying to the server, you know, forgive us. We're in this Italian restaurant. We want to really like be Italian. And we're like, she just likes it with butter. And she was like an older server and she Italian. And she said, that is the best pasta. It's butter and pasta and you get the real that. And she like really played it up and yeah. She was sincere. She wasn't doing it to pacify my daughter. And she walked away and we're like, oh, my daughter was like, see, I was right the whole time.
You're like buttered pasta for the table all around. Right.
Exactly. Trying to be all fancy.
Yeah. Pasta with butter and Parmesan definitely has its place in Italy.
When you're weak or your tummy hurts or something's not right, you either are fed like rice or butter and Parmesan pasta. Yeah, I mean, you would find this on a hospital menu, basically.
That's Katie Parla, Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author. You may have also seen her on shows like Stanley Tucci Searching for Italy or Chef's Table Pizza. Katie says this simple dish, something Italians would only make at home, found its way onto a Roman restaurant menu in 1908, where it was named Fettuccine Alfredo.
So the legend states that Alfredo di Lelio was trying to help his ailing wife after she gave birth, and so he made a dish for her that you would just give to sick people in Italy, and you still do. Pasta with butter and Parmigiano. And he named it after himself. So he doesn't really invent anything. Italians had been eating like mac and cheese essentially for a really long time, but he masters the marketing around it and it becomes his thing. And people generally would eat this at home when they didn't feel well. So it really takes a big leap to get people to order it and pay money for it at a restaurant. And he does it with his charisma.
Did he already have a restaurant?
Yeah, he already had a family restaurant currently not far from the Pantheon, and that's where Alfredo alla Scrofa resides.
So it's just pasta and Parmigiano and butter. Is there a method to it, like that emulsifies it and makes it a creamy sauce?
Yes. So mantecatura, which I guess you would translate in English to emulsification. And a lot of what enticed people to order this super simple dish was that Alfredo would turn up to the table with a pile of pasta, butter, and Parmigiano, and then use a set of spoons and his wrists to toss the ingredients together until they were silky and emulsified. And this didn't just gain the affection of his local patrons, but also Hollywood celebrities who probably are responsible for spreading it back to America.
The United States is where fettuccine Alfredo hit its stride. But the way that we know the dish, with a thick cream-based sauce, is almost impossible to find in Italy.
When I moved to Italy, I was like, guys, where's the fettuccine Alfredo at? And people did not know what I was talking about. It's a super specific dish, famous basically in just two restaurants in Rome.
Oh, really? So it only exists in two restaurants?
You can find it in some tourist traps that get like frozen versions with all the other bad food that they sell, because they're responding to the demands of visitors who believe that it is a classic Italian dish when it's, again, like a super hyper-specific recipe.
So the restaurant is still there, Alfredo alla Scrofa. Is it still run by his family?
It's not. So during the Second World War, the DeLelio family sold it. And then later opened a competing Alfredo, which is called Il Vero Alfredo, which means the real Alfredo. And yes, this is meant to be like petty. And just like its rival, it's got some local patrons, but it's mostly American tourists who go there looking for their favorite dish.
What do you think of the dish?
It tastes good. But, you know... I love fettuccine. I would have to say, like, as far as Roman fettuccine dishes go, my favorite is actually corrigati di pollo, so a tomato-based sauce with chicken gizzards and livers. I like a little more texture with my toothsome fettuccine, but I would not turn down fettuccine Alfredo. It was my favorite dish growing up as a kid, but my mom added cream to it, like whipped cream that she would fold in. I thought that was very decadent. And sometimes, you know, a shrimp would end up in there, which, don't tell any Romans I ate that.
Yes, I know. I put Parmesan on my seafood pasta, too. The beauty of living in America. Yeah, so that is the big difference, that in the States, all fettuccine Alfredo has cream or milk in it.
Totally. Yeah, here, really, like, if you ask most people, do you know about fettuccine Alfredo? They might have heard about it in, like, a touristic sense. But if you say, like, have you heard of pasta burre parmigiano? They'd be like, obviously, I ate that the last time I had a stomachache. But never is cream involved.
What are some other Italian-American dishes that Americans might expect to see when they go visit Italy, but they really can't find on any menus?
Honestly, almost all of them. So the big one is we only have eggplant and zucchini parmesan here. There is no veal or chicken parmesan. We don't use tomato sauce in chicken cacciatore. You know, so many examples of like classics, like hoagies and meatball subs, things like that, that don't really exist here. Although there are some like fast food concepts that are putting meatballs in bread. This is a pretty novel, modern invention.
And spaghetti and meatballs too. That's not a thing, is it?
Okay, so this is one of those things where Italians will tell you there's no such thing as spaghetti and meatballs. And then you go to Loreto Puntino in Abruzzo and they serve the cutest little meatballs. They're like the size of plump raisins tossed with spaghetti alla chitarra. But most Italians haven't been there. They don't know about it. And so they just say it doesn't exist. But it does. It's just a super hyper regional specialty.
Oh, I like the idea of that is tinier than I thought. Tiny little raisin sized meatballs.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever had like a Chef Boyardee situation, those like little meatball nuggets? It's kind of, we're working with that.
When the pandemic started and everyone was rushing to the grocery store and buying 4 years worth of groceries, I didn't really do that, but I bought like a few comfort items and I did buy Chef Boyardee because my parents wouldn't let me have it when I was a kid. And for some reason, my brain triggered. I was going down the aisles. I'm like, this is my moment. If we're all going to die, I want to die eating Chef Boyardee out of a can.
Yeah, give me some sugary tomato sauce and call it a day.
I mean, it is actually very good.
It tastes good. And actually, it was a company founded by an Italian guy, but his last name was Boyardi, and it got anglicized.
Right, right. I was curious if noodles with butter is a ubiquitous kid food in Italy, just like it is in the States.
Not to the same extent. And like here, we don't have kids' restaurants. We have restaurants, and kids go to them, and they generally choose little bites of what the adults are eating. But I would say 9 out of 10 times when I see a kid having their own dish, it's pasta al pomodoro. So just pasta with tomato sauce. And they might try like, you know, the calamari or the grilled pig liver or whatever happens to be on the table around them. But if they're having their own dedicated dish, it's pasta with tomato.
If I have a bad day or if I am very tired, my go-to meal has always been a big bowl of buttered pasta with Parmesan, salt, and lemon. Sometimes I mix in Greek yogurt and a little dash of nutmeg, which I guess is my own version of fettuccine Alfredo. It is a lifelong comfort food, and I always have all of these ingredients laying around. When we come back, Tom Papa shares his last meal. Listening to Your Last Meal, you might like watching my new TV show, The Nosh with Rachel Bell. We just wrapped up season one, so there are 4 tasty episodes ready for you to binge at cascadepbs.org. In episode 1, I convince an East Coast skeptic that Seattle now has fantastic bagels. And in the season finale, we go truffle hunting just about an hour outside of Seattle. Episodes are a quick bite. Just 8.5 minutes long. So grab a snack and cozy up with The Nosh. Available anytime, anywhere at cascadepbs.org or find a link in the show notes. Well, you've said when you're on the road touring as a comedian that other comedians are going to bars and you're going to bakeries. And you've also done this, you know, on a TV show. What kind of things did you discover when you were traveling the country going into different bakeries?
They were such great people. Mm. You know, I had the show on the Food Network for like 6 episodes. But man, nobody goes and opens a shop making cupcakes for the town as an ass.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? They tend to be pretty great people.
Yeah.
And it's such hard work. My bread is really good and I give it away to a lot of people. And you always kind of play around like, oh, maybe we would open a shop at one point. And the work and the hours, it takes so much of your blood, sweat, and tears that you really have to be dedicated to it and want to do it. And every city, different ethnicities, different types of baking, I really like truly loved them all. I wanted to spend more time with all of them. And I just spent like one day with them, Termini Brothers in Philadelphia. And every time I come near Philly, it's like I have to get over to see them. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's the biggest thing that I learned, that they're pretty much across the board great, great people. I mean, it's a grind. I mean, I was so naive. Every time I would like walk into a coffee shop in the morning and there was this beautiful case of pastries, like those are always there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Just appear. Poof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you realize, no, someone was in here at 2 o'clock in the morning breaking open the flour and getting this all started.
Yeah.
Made me really, really respect it.
Okay. Let's get to the crux of the podcast, which is, what would your last meal be?
I think about it all the time. I was talking about this with my wife last night. She was saying she never really thinks about food. And I said, that's all I think about.
Yeah.
Is food. That's all I think about. And I've had different last meals throughout my life. Like it was like big Italian stuff. But right now, my last meal is definitely a really charbroiled steak, like that crusty, just beautiful outside with the beautiful medium rare inside, the classic baked potato vegetable thing. It could be fries also. You could swap that out with a nice, really funky, funky glass of red wine.
Mm.
You know, something that's going to be a little bit like, did this come from a clay pot?
Did this come from a writer's room?
Right, exactly. And again, this is that this moment, like it changes throughout time. But
yeah,
that to me is like the perfect meal.
Is there any meaning behind it, any symbolism or emotional meaning, or is it all pure taste?
I think it's all pure taste. Like for a while, it was different Italian stuff, you know, like that basic, which is my family's kind of lineage. And I have a lot of emotional ties to that. I don't think there's like an emotional, historic thing. It's just pure taste. And there is that ritual. I think as I get older, like the celebratory meals that I have, always end up being in a steakhouse. Like when I, with my friends from high school, we meet at Christmas time every year, and it's like 10 of us and we all get together and we just have known each other forever. That's in a steakhouse. When I have like a, do some kind of TV appearance, that's a steakhouse. When I'm in LA and you can go to Musso and Frank's, just like the oldest restaurant in LA with guys with the, you know, career waiters. That's a steakhouse. There's something about the grown-up celebratory element of that that is probably at play.
So what is that like, your relationship with your wife involving food? Does she get annoyed that you talk about food all the time? Does that like have any sort of impact on the way that your relationship works? Do you have to like have other people on the outside that you talk about food with?
I don't know. Kind of. If the chore is to go to the grocery store, I'm excited.
Yes.
I'm really excited, right? You're excited.
I would honestly, if I had time, go down every aisle every time I went to the grocery store. I love looking at everything and seeing what's there.
I know. You're like, oh, right, salt. I'm running low.
And I like all the packaging because like there's such good packaging now for some things. I mean, especially things like beer.
I know. Beer, you're right. I part of my rider when I'm out doing shows is local IPA. And I take pictures of every label and send them to my brother-in-law because he really like loves them. They're beautiful.
I mean,
of these are really amazing.
Yeah.
So, but what to your question, I'll plan it out all day. I'm thinking, what am I going to try and make tonight or what am I going to do? And she won't discuss it, but she appreciates it.
Okay.
You know, like she's a teacher. She comes home, she's spent, and that I can just put out this really nice meal for her, that we've just kind of gotten into that rhythm. And the conversation is replaced by her just being really appreciative.
A charbroiled steak, a baked potato, a vegetable, and a funky glass of red wine at a steakhouse. That is Tom Papa's last meal.
Been looking forward to this all day.
This is
everything I love to talk about.
Go to TomPapa.com to find links to his podcast, Breaking Bread with Tom Papa, his tour schedule, and everything else he's created. Thanks to Katie Parla. Her newest cookbook is called Food of the Italian Islands, and it has the most gorgeous cover. If you're headed to Italy, you can book a tour with Katie, which if you follow her on Instagram, you are definitely going to want to do. And her Italian food podcast is called Gola. Find it all at katieparla.com.
Just one like public service announcement on behalf of Rome. There are more than 4 Roman pastas. So you might not find fettuccine Alfredo in many places. Of course, you'll find gricia, carbonara, matriciana, and cacio e pepe everywhere. But those are 4 of like the 20 major pasta dishes. And don't sleep on the pasta plus sauce meat's been cooked in. So pasta that's made with like the sauce oxtails have simmered in or the sauce meat rolls have simmered in. Those are real comfort items that define this city's cuisine just as much as carbonara does.
So they've taken the meat out and that's for another dish. And so you just have the sauce that the meat simmered in without the meat in it?
Correct.
Oh, that sounds really good. Your Last Meal is a product of Cascade PBS. The podcast was created and hosted by me. This episode was produced by me and Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Isaac also did the mastering, and I'm just so happy I get to work with him. Original theme music by Prom Queen. Make sure you're following along on Instagram. I'm Hello Rachel Bell. Say it with me now, B-E-L-L-E. You can follow my newsletter, rachelbell.substack.com. Last week I posted about losing my voice. At the time, it was 2.5 days. I ended up not being able to speak for almost 5 days. You can read the whole story at rachelbell.substack.com. And if you want to send an email, if you have a question, if you have a guest suggestion, if you want to advertise on the show, go to yourlastmealpodcast.com. And make sure you check out my new TV show. It's called The Nosh with Rachel Bell. It's on Cascade PBS. You can watch it anywhere, anytime at cascadepbs.org. Or if you are local in Western Washington or BC, you can watch it Friday nights at 8:50 p.m. on Channel 9. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal.
Big Tom fan, so excited.
He is the sweetest person. You'll be happy to know as a fan. He's just so nice.
He's awesome. And he's a very talented baker. And I just love everything about him. Stuff was happening at the turn of the 20th century in Rome. And the place that it was kind of like demolished in order to make way for a giant mall, which as a Jersey native, I can get behind. But